The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Today we'll be talking about the trial of Huang Guangyu, one of China's richest men, and what the trial says about wealth, corruption, and the rule of law in China today. Then we'll move on to the topic on everyone's lips in today's China, rising real estate prices and Beijing's efforts to rein them in. With me today at the pop-up Chinese studio in Beijing are regulars Bill Bishop, who's been writing quite a bit about real estate at his blog Sinicism.com. How are you, Bill?
Great, thanks, Kaiser.
Also joining us is Will Moss, the man behind the blog ImageThief.com.
Hi, Kaiser.
And we're also joined today again, this week, by Gadi Epstein, bureau chief for Forbes magazine. Gentlemen, welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Let's hop right in here. Huang Guangyu and the curse of the Chinese rich. The trial of Huang, who by some counts is China's richest man, began here in Beijing last Thursday, the 22nd of April. The multi-billionaire was detained in November 2008 on suspicion of bribery, insider trading, and a host of other white-collar crimes. Gadi, let's start with you. Who is Huang Guangyu? Superficially, at least, he sounds like a Horatio Alger story, doesn't he?
That's right. He was born a poor family near Shantou in Guangdong. He was a school dropout, one of four kids. He and his brother started selling miscellaneous electronics at a very early age and eventually built that into Gome, the electronics retail giant. He became China's richest man, according to Forbes, in 2006 with a fortune over $6 billion.
And what is he actually alleged to have done, Bill? Are you familiar with what his actual litany of crimes or alleged
crimes? I think what he's been charged with is insider trading, bribery, as well as what looks to be a money laundering charge under the guise of illegally operating a business.
Yeah,
I guess that up to he can be sentenced up to 20 years for the three charges.
Right. Apparently, he had swapped something like 800 million Hong Kong dollars with the niece of some guy who is known as the gambling king of the high seas.
This guy Lian Chao. He runs it, and who was detained. I don't know, has he been released or not?
But yeah, Lian Chao has been detained, right?
He apparently was quite a big gambler and was quite a frequent visitor to the. He runs the biggest gambling boat in Hong Kong. So Huang Guangyu was quite a big visitor, customer of his, and apparently I think used his gambling trips to also take a lot of officials with him. And so the bribery charge stems from issues around Guome taxes, where the company has actually been charged with the crime as well, and that's related to paying people off to make the problems go away. And what's interesting is actually three years ago, Tai Jing had a long article about Huang Guangyu being investigated and his brother investigated for auto loan fraud. And they said he was going to imminently be detained. Mm-hmm. And then mysteriously that case went away.
Yeah, that's strange. I mean, it might have something to do with the bribes that he's alleged to.
Right. And what's interesting, too, who he bribed were one, I think the highest ranking person, at least who's been charged so far, was the guy who was ranked number 10 in the Ministry of Public Security.
That's right.
But apparently it's linked to people, officials in Guangdong and Zhejiang, and several of them are also from Shantou. So it's also into this
hometown
connection, informal networks.
Almost every official I think that's been caught in the dragnet has Guangdong roots, or they were an official in Guangdong.
But a lot of them were actually in the white-collar crimes unit of the Ministry of Public Security.
Oh, he paid the right people off.
Yeah. Apparently not. Maybe not enough.
not everyone, but at least he found the right target, at least at the beginning.
And what about these insider trading charges?
Well, from what I understand anecdotally, that may have been sort of how he was caught. He was doing share manipulation of two companies that were under his control. And I think there was a relatively substantial amount of money involved. That might not have all been all his, but it's sort of unclear.
I read somewhere about he had set up something like 80 dummy companies, accounts with
security. And it ties in with his brother because they actually have a real estate company on the side. You would know this best, right, from the Forbes list, but almost any of these guys, if you look hard enough, you're going to find something.
Guome itself has been hit pretty hard by this, right? There have been quite a few store closures, and actually their stock was suspended from trade.
But they raised several hundred million dollars from Bain Capital last summer.
Yeah, I guess
right. Their stock dove. Huang Guangyu's status as one of China's richest has slipped dramatically.
I imagine so.
He's definitely no longer a billionaire. He's down to 130th on the
We shouldn't forget his wife actually is charged as well. And his wife ran the finances for Guome. She originally, I think, was at like the Bank of China, Beijing branch.
His older brother has also been indicted, but he's been detained. I'm not sure if he's been brought up on charges just yet. Gadi, how high up does this go? We were talking about some people in the Ministry of Public Security.
It's already going quite high. You're talking about the head of the Zhejiang Province Commission for Discipline Inspection of the Communist Party, who was also very high up in Guangdong before that. It's related to his time in Guangdong. And you have another high-up public security official from Guangdong. You have other people who are now or were later in high-ranking positions in Beijing, high court in Guangdong, Supreme Court in Beijing. I mean, it's quite a long list that have been caught.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You can go as high as is politically feasible.
So what does this mean for the average person who's watching this? Will, what's your sense of how the Chinese press has been playing this and what reaction on the street has been to Huang's arrest?
I think these kinds of things are always symbolic, and a trial like this cannot not be symbolic. This isn't exclusively a Chinese thing. You know, big trials of famous people, particularly where corruption is involved, are always sending some kind of message to society. As for what the impact is on normal people, I think it's very hard to say. The spin that's given to the trial is going to be the spin the government wants on it. If they want it to be purely commercial, it'll be purely commercial. There's always, in any country, particularly a country that's had a fast emerging rich class, there's always going to be a conflicting set of emotions and a touch of that eat the rich mentality. So I do think you might find some sense of, well, he was corrupt, he's getting what's coming to him. But there's so many other things going on, and there's so many things going on with the emergence of a wealthy class in China that I don't imagine that the impact from this case alone is going to be huge. And I don't think it's going to have the same kind of impact as some of the high-profile prosecutions of political figures in the last few years has had.
Gadi, I mean, I'm inclined to think maybe I don't want to make it onto Forbes' rich list anymore. I mean, that was my aspiration for an awfully long time, but they seem to be cursed.
That might be a slight bit of overstatement, but not too far. About a year ago, I wrote a column about this novelist, Wang Gong. He wrote the book English, and he also wrote a novella called The Curse of Forbes, modeled basically after Pan Zhiyin Zhang Xin, the chairman and CEO of Soho China, one of the biggest real estate companies in China. And basically, it's a kind of a critical assessment of the rich, but also, there's a little bit of sympathy in there. He was telling me that he considers the rich a tragic class because not only does everybody hate them, the poor and the middle class, but they also never know when maybe they'll be locked away by the government.
There's a point there because a moment ago we were talking about the symbolism of the trial and how the person on the street felt about this trial. The person on the street is not the target audience of this trial. Other rich people are the target audience of this trial. So the question isn't how Joe Average walking down the sidewalk feels about it. It's how everybody else who's on the rich list feels about it and what they think it means to them.
And officials.
We spoke a few minutes ago about the fact that Huang Guangyu had this sort of web of people from Guangdong that he was tied to. And one of the things that sets, I think, the government's nerves tingling a little bit is the sense of the emergence of unofficial webs of influence that compete with the official webs of influence, or the webs of influence that are manipulated by the political class. And that's a real issue with the rise of wealth in this country. And I think that's one of the messages that comes out of this.
Informal webs of influence in China?
I know. Imagine what were the chances of that?
In defense of the Forbes rich list, I think, though, one, the folks who made their wealth through IT, like Pony Ma from Tencent or William
Robin
Ding from
Lee, Eddie,
Robin
yeah.
Lee from Baidu,
Charles
Chen Jianqiao from Shanda, Charles Zhang from Sohu. Yeah, I think those guys are actually relatively clean.
Yeah.
And one of the things on the rich list, I mean, a lot of the wealth on that list comes from people who have made their fortunes in industries that actually have state-owned competitors. And so they've had to figure out how to work within the confines of having a in a sector with controlled resources or a competitor who's actually backed by the government, whereas IT was wide open.
Is that the case with white goods?
It's a real estate business.
It's
very much a real estate business. Back then when he started, it wasn't as wide open with brands. You had a lot of control over the brands and distribution.
It's not just about getting rich cleanly, though. It's also what happens once you get very rich. Your behavior, you sort of start to act like you're above the law, possibly. You can. You have that temptation. Huang Gongyu certainly built his network after he became rich.
He
may have acted like he was above the law if everything is alleged against him is true.
And one of my favorite quotes from somebody who's a Beijing friend who's been pretty successful was he said, you got to remember, no matter how rich you get, at the end of the day, in the eyes of the Chinese government, you're all peasants.
Well, you look at people back in 2002, there were a couple like there was like a series of arrests back then. There's Yang Bin, the Dutch tulip king, who had made the mistake of making an agreement to develop an economic zone in North Korea. Without apparently getting permission. He got arrested. He may have done some other things, but who knows whether he would have been caught or arrested for those things if he hadn't, kind of put himself out there in a way the government didn't like. There was the actress, if you can help me for a second, who was arrested for tax evasion back here.
Her name totally slips my mind.
Right. Anyways, they like to make these examples, and I think that's why Will is right. In the Huang Gongyu case, I'm sure you could find a number of people who've done share manipulation and insider trading. To pick one of the richest men in China certainly sends a message.
And do we know that they unraveled this web of corruption by figuring out that Huang Gongyu was corrupt, or they actually found something on one of the officials and then followed that trail into Huang Gongyu?
It's hard to say. I mean, he certainly wasn't the first person who was arrested in this whole network. But this is a case then not of really killing the chicken to scare the monkey, but more of like killing the 800-pound gorilla to scare the other gorillas or to scare the other monkeys.
Well, somebody is supposed to be scared. That much is clear.
Right, right. One of the bloggers that I like to read here, this guy named Stan Abrams, who's a lawyer, writes a blog, which I'd highly recommend, called China Hearsay. He had one of the more interesting comments that I had read on this. He was asking about how this trial impacts rule of law in China or perceptions about rule of law. Let me just quote from him really quick. He said, whenever there's a high-level case like this, there are possible opportunities to affect rule of law, specifically public perception of the judicial system. There are three options to consider here, he says. One is putting the richest guy in the country on trial will further the concept that no one is above the law. Two, seeing the most successful person in the country taken down will further the cynical notion that corruption is rife and the economic system really doesn't work. Or three, neither. No rule of law implications because there are complicating factors. And Stan actually concludes that the benefits of this are marginal, that cynicism is running at such high levels already that it won't really increase this notion already quite present that everyone is already, any rich person is corrupt. People will see this as kind of selective prosecution. Do you guys have any thoughts on this? Do you agree with Stan?
The issue with these kinds of things is the difference between a system that is designed around making examples of people, which is what often happens here, and a system that is designed to be fairly applied. And I don't think many people would argue that China has quite got there yet. I contrast it with Singapore, where I lived for almost 10 years before I came to China. Here, it becomes quite clear that people are made examples of, that Huang Gongyu is prosecuted or Qian Liangyu is prosecuted, or we're going to cherry pick these certain people based on the message we want to send, based on their influence, patronage, the degree of the crime. I said before, I contrast this with Singapore. In Singapore, the mentality I think is quite different. There, the mentality that's been built over time by very scrupulous application of the judicial system is, if I do something bad, I will be caught.
Places like Singapore and Hong Kong have handled anti-corruption exceptionally well, for East Asia especially. What are some of the lessons you guys think we can draw here in China from the way, say, for example, that Hong Kong handles
corruption? I'm not sure you can, because they're all of, 6 million people, 8 million people.
They're very, very different.
They're like a small district in Beijing.
That's right.
In many ways, different cultural backgrounds.
I think the problem with what Will is saying there is that you have a very small political elite, ruling elite in those, especially in Singapore. And obviously in Hong Kong it's a slightly different – it's not just a ruling elite. You have the tycoons as well. But in China you have 70 plus million party members. Right. They all have vested interests, and people that are being that they're protecting or that are protecting them. It makes any prosecution much more complicated. And so that's why people will naturally assume there's an element of selective prosecution. It may be that the overall climate is it's getting tougher to get away with things, but everybody will still think that you can get away with it if you have the right level of protection.
That issue, the size issue, is for real, by the way. I think people often have the same sense in the U.S. You know, certain people get lucky. Certain people are singled out and prosecuted. Probably not to the degree that happens here, but it does happen. Again, watch and see how things play out with prosecutions around the financial crisis.
Right. I mean, the thing about being singled out, though, I mean, the question I have in the Huang Guangyu case is we don't really know the actual genesis of the case. Did someone say, oh, I'm pissed at Guoman, I'm pissed at Huang Guangyu, let's go get him? Or did something else happen, like they realized that a senior party member was corrupt? And then you have some outside businessman who's corrupting the party, quote unquote, right?
Right.
And
that reminds me.
And then he leads to Huang Guangyu, and he just happens to be that person, as opposed to we want to take him down. Same thing with the Rio Tinto case. Were these guys actually targeted, or because it was such a sensitive industry for China? So much China was spending so much money that they were investigating the Chinese guys.
Right.
The Chinese steel mills, and they come across these evidence of bribery, the bribes that the Rio Tinto guys are taking, and then they go after Rio Tinto. We don't know.
Or were they going after Rio Tinto?
Right, we don't know. The assumption is, at least in the Rio Tinto case, they targeted Rio Tinto. But the Chinese government, as you know, doesn't have a great PR strategy, and they certainly leave the impression that they targeted them, but we actually don't know that for sure.
That was Will nodding emphatically. Gotti, you had something?
Right. Well, that's the price they pay for not having a transparent system.
Exactly.
Is the thing. And this reminds me a little bit of the Zhou Zhenyi case in 2003, because he sort of was a domino that fell. He wasn't the first one.
Give us a little background.
Zhou Zhenyi was also one of China's richest. He was on the Forbes rich list.
Again, the
case. He was behind a big redevelopment in the center of Shanghai. He was kicking out a bunch of people from their homes. That became a bit of a political controversy. The person who ended up challenging him, a lawyer who ended up challenging him on that, ended up in jail. But so in the end did Zhou Zhenyi for unrelated crimes that came out of an investigation that started in Hong Kong. And there's a question, you know, Zhou Zhenyi was protected at that time. He was part of the Shanghai faction. And there's a question of whether was there factional politics involved in him? Did he lose protection and thus have to go to jail because Hu Jintao, you know, wanted to – you know, send a message, or was it just a natural outgrowth of an investigation?
Obvious and embarrassing. Nobody wants to help him anymore. Yeah, the Huang Guangyu trial was actually one day.
Right.
Even though apparently they reviewed the evidence the day before, so it was at least 2 days.
That's pretty fast for.
And all of the public seats or tickets to view the proceedings were actually given away before the public got
there. There was one Xinhua reporter who was actually right.
I wouldn't call that a public.
And as of this taping, we've seen no verdict yet.
No, we've seen no verdict. It's not expected for a couple of weeks, I understand. What do you anticipate? What's the Chinese press saying is a likely outcome of this? What's he going to get?
It's up to 20 years, but right. I haven't seen any. Have you seen speculation about what he might get?
Well, we should start off. It goes without saying he's going to be convicted.
Yeah, I think
over 90%.
There goes my bet in the pool.
but I think I've seen 15 years. I've seen various estimates. Who knows?
Okay, very good. Let's move on to our next topic here. Whether they own property or not, there's nothing that people across China are talking about more than real estate prices. Property prices in 70 cities in China rose by a whopping 11.7% just in March. There was record growth of new loans last year to over $1.4 trillion actually in 2009 in new real estate-related loans. People all over China are talking about the phenomenon of house slaves, of people who are actually enslaved to their mortgage, working only to pay off what they owe on their homes. And not long ago, Wo Ju, a very popular television show that was actually taken off air but is still being aired on China's major internet video sites, had over 175 million views just on Youku, which I should add is a company that I consult for. This is a major topic. Bears like Jim Chanos and Andy Xie, who was formerly of Morgan Stanley, are putting the scare in a lot of people. Chanos talks often about shorting China, about Dubai times 1,000. And in a Bloomberg commentary written by Xie the other day, he compared these anecdotes that he's heard about maids in Beijing taking time off to go back home and buy real estate. He compares these to the Shoeshine Boys, whose stock tips supposedly clued in Joseph Kennedy to the imminent crash of 1929. Gotti, let's start with you. Explain in layman's terms.
None of that pointy-headed stuff.
Yeah,
I'll try.
Why Beijing is on the horns of a dilemma with this. Why they're, on the one hand, addicted to rising prices, and why they also face very real dangers from a continuing rise.
Right. Well, on the first part, there's a very basic need for the rising prices on the part of the government, which is land sales. Rising real estate prices means higher land values. And the government, which local governments all around the country, when they need to fund their budget, the most popular way to do that is to sell land. And land prices have been going up. That means revenue has been increasing. They're selling even more land. This is also, of course, a problem for the government, this rush to sell land. But it's also, in the short term, a solution to funding problems. So that's one reason why it's important for them, why rising prices has been beneficial to them.
Right.
Another thing is the psychology of the economy. So the more prices are going up, there's more of a feeling of confidence in the Chinese economy. There's a psychological kind of knock-on effect also in the stock market. And anytime prices start dipping, you see the reverse psychological effect. You see the stock market go down. You see people being a little bit worried about the economy at large, even if the connection between the real estate economy and the economy at large is not necessarily, you know, as lockstep as that.
And what's the danger then if there's obviously a problem if they continue to allow prices to rise as they have been 11.7% in 1 month?
Right. The danger is definitely that average people are no longer able to afford homes in the middle of big cities or even maybe on the outskirts of big cities these days. They feel like a reasonable apartment is out of reach for your average, you know, middle class consumer. Yet they need to get one to get married, to have any sort of status.
Yeah, it's a sine qua non now for the marrying guy, right?
Right.
You need to own a car and own a home. Of course, I had neither when I proposed to my wife. I had what was called a naked marriage.
Please never give us an image of your naked marriage.
I'll try not to.
I don't know. I'm kind of enjoying it. No,
and of course, then the other side of that is if they do anything that brings prices down too quickly or brings about a crash in the real estate market, that could have not only a psychological knock-on effect but a real knock-on effect on the economy, depending on how bad it is.
An advisor to the People's Bank of China was on Bloomberg earlier this week, and he said exactly that. He said this round of tightening property measures, you know, we don't expect it to drop prices more than 10%, because if they drop more than 10%, we'll have a whole set of other social stability issues.
Well, let's talk about those regulations. Bill, actually, you've been writing quite a bit about this. There have been a spate of new regulations, actually, that are aimed at taking some of the air out of what looks increasingly like a bubble. What are some of the steps that the government's taking in an effort to keep a lid on these rising prices?
Well, first, to give some framework for it, I mean, the real estate market in China is not a market economy. Remember, it's not a market economy in the U.S. either. Look at Fannie Freddie, look at the Fed buying $1 trillion-plus in mortgage-backed securities in the last year. So housing is generally not something that works in a free market. And most governments, it has a whole set of other public goods and social welfare issues. So one, when you look at how China approaches the housing market and these controls, they used what Westerners consider to be sort of bad economic or non-economic measures. Instead of raising interest rates, they limit the number of houses you can buy. They limit the number of mortgages you can take out. They have rules around people. You have to be a resident of a city to buy an apartment in that city. Then they also raised the down payment required.
Let's drill down a little bit about it. So specifically, last week we had this new document number 10 mm-hmm. issued by the State Council. What specifically did that say?
That limited it was an issued document because it said in cities where prices are too high and have risen too fast, the local government should start limiting mortgages on third or more properties. They should raise down payments.
Down payments, we should add, I mean, for people who don't live in China, they're at 30% right
now. Down payments, there is no subprime market in the sense that you can go in and get, like, buy a house with 5% down.
You can't get a ninja loan in China? I'm scandalized.
you can, but it's gotten much harder. So this idea that, you know, all these loans are going to go bad, I mean, the prices have to drop 30, 40, 50% before you see people being underwater on their mortgages.
Right. There's a little bit of squishiness that it sounds like in the language there. In cities where property prices are rising too fast, what does that actually mean?
That's an interesting – I think it's the central government is putting out this directive and laying a policy framework about how they want to control housing, but they're leaving some wiggle room for the local governments for, and for what reason? One reason is what Gadi was talking about, which is it's the local governments are in a real bind because they are so heavily reliant on the revenue from land sales that to immediately shut that off would cause them a lot of problem.
Is this just going to create some giant nationwide arbitrage opportunity, or people are just going to go to where the terms are the easiest?
Actually, they're already doing that.
Well, developers are doing that. Individuals maybe in small numbers, but most people can only afford one house.
And you've got to remember, this is immobile, right? This is real estate. Right. This isn't stuff that you can take with you and go back to the city that you live in. I mean, people who live in Beijing are not necessarily going to want to buy
property. No, but if it does become a speculative mania, people become a lot freer about how and why they do this.
If it does, of course it is already.
When it is, let me rephrase myself. When it is a speculative mania, the approaches to this stop being quite so rational, perhaps.
Of course, we've been seeing investors buy apartments that they leave empty actually for years in China now. And it's been going on, and it's gone through a number of different steps of the government saying, market's overheating, let's bring in these tougher measures. Then they get pulled back if they seem like they're too effective. This has been a back and forth now, I think, since at least like 2004.
Or even earlier.
I mean, 2008. Yeah. You
can go back to Zhu Rongji's time.
Right, but before the financial crash in 2008, the government rolled out a whole bunch of measures to cool off the market. They dropped prices in some places 30%. But then as soon as the crash hit, and starting around, I think last year, the bottom of the market, at least in Beijing, was right around Chinese New Year in February.
Yeah, it was January,
right around then, they started just pumping money into the market through the easy credit, and then they started pulling back on, you got discounts on your mortgage interest rate if it was your first place, and all sorts of administrative rules to provide a fill to the housing market. And it basically turbocharged the market over the last year.
And allowed a couple of very struggling developers to IPO and get some money out of some what I would think are pretty stupid investors.
So now the government's come back in with this whole new round of, they haven't raised interest rates officially. They've started raising rates on the mortgage loans themselves, so that banks no longer can give. So some places you would get a sort of a 70% discount on the baseline rate if you were your first time buying. They're getting rid of all those policies. Today in the Beijing papers, they're saying they're probably going to limit the actual amount of houses an individual household can buy in Beijing, mortgage or not.
I've also seen some proposed regulations that suggest developers are not going to be able to sell any property that hasn't actually been completed yet. I think most people in Beijing who buy a new place buy it well before, maybe sometimes even when ground's been broken.
Well, the rule has been for a while now that the developers couldn't sell until they had actually put the roof on the building.
Right.
So it wasn't fully completed, but it was, the roof was on it. And so the way the developers got around it was you could buy a VIP card, you could pay 50,000 RMB to get a special number, which was effectively just a pre-deposit. And so when they could officially sell it, whatever you paid for a VIP card
counts
or your special
that,
club counts against your down payment. One of the new regulations that came out, I mean, the Chinese government knows all the tricks the developers play. They have a very specific set of regulations to go after all these, I think it was like 8 or 10 different things. Now, of course, there are probably 10 other ones they haven't thought of. But it's making, they're putting the squeeze on the developers as well as they're trying to put the squeeze on the speculators in buying the properties. I mean, it's a much, much deeper issue than just these administrative measures. I mean, you've got the latest issue of Taishin has a very good editorial from Hu Shuli about how the fundamental cause is the imbalance in the economy and how it's not a market economy, and yet parts of it have been treated like a market economy. And the only way to really deal with the real estate issue is to have a much broader set of reforms. Mm. Now, that's going to take years. So in the meantime, the government has to come in with very effective administrative measures, which have taken the market by surprise. And most analysts, or almost all of them, would tell you that these were much more targeted and much harsher than anyone was expecting.
So what
and
has
more
the,
to come.
Yeah, what has the impact been on developers, actually? I mean, what's happened to
their share
prices? Well,
developer stocks have gotten hit. The stock market went down, was it 5% on the Monday after this document number 10 came out?
And they kept going down. And some of the biggest state-owned developers went down more than 5% on that first day.
Will, give us a sense. I mean, for people who are not in China right now and don't live in one of the major Chinese cities where this is just everywhere, give us a sense of just how crazed real estate is right now. I know that when I stop at an intersection, I am immediately surrounded by these sort of shabbily dressed men from the provinces waving brochures at me.
People think it's a roaring frotherama. In my own development, if you look at the stores that open in the basement levels, a shocking number of them in the last year have turned into property offices, not to mention the guys standing on the corner.
Right.
The spam I get to my mobile phone in the last year, the consistency of the spam has changed. It has changed from mostly fa piao.
Fa piao are illegal, well, sort right. of false receipts.
Right. That it changed mostly from black market receipts to property ads. It has become the widespread topic of discussion. We were talking about this before. This has been the lead in the foreign journalism articles about the market here is how, you know, unlikely people are talking about the property market. But you kind of led with that as well today. So it's become this all-consuming thing. And to me as an observer, it strikes me as deeply pathological and deeply worrying. I have dark and gloomy memories of 1997 and living in Southeast Asia.
Right. You were there. You were living in Singapore during
that
time.
When the bottom dropped right out. And, you know, it recovered from that. So did Hong Kong, which had a rough time, and Thailand. You know, all of Southeast Asia was really hit then. And people got hurt really badly, and there were 2 or 3 years of pain coming out of that. So we were talking before that China is not the same as Southeast Asia. They're all managed real estate. They're all managed property markets. They're all basically quasi-socialized property markets.
Sure.
But the change in tone over the last year has been pretty shocking, and the degree to which it's infected public consciousness has been pretty shocking. And these are the kind of things that make me really wonder what comes next. If it's true what we were talking about before, that the government is walking this path between wanting the market to continue growing but not growing so fast that it has social unrest and not, you know, cooling it off sometimes but not cooling it off so much that it has social unrest. They have a lot of tools here for managing the market, but it could be pretty ugly either way if they lose control of this thing. It's a very difficult balance.
One of the tools they've been talking about an awful lot but actually have not done nothing on yet is a property tax. What's the state of discussion right now around the introduction of property taxes in China?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the next round of these administrative measures are actually – and it's a set of measures China has used before – are around taxes. But they're not actually around an annual U.S. or Hong Kong-style property tax. They're more around transaction taxes. So you pay more when you sell your place. You pay more capital. You pay
– stamp tax.
Stamp tax, transaction tax, maybe even a capital gains tax, which they don't really have here. And one of the things that really drove the market last year was they – previously you had to hold the property for 5 years.
That's
or else
right.
you're going to be subject to – I think it was – forget the number. I think it was
pretty handsome tax.
It was a big amount. And then they said, oh, now it's now it's 2 years. So all of a sudden the speculators could come in. So expect – most people expect that those sets of taxes will come back in and probably be more onerous and probably be more progressive in terms of the bigger your property is as well as the more units you own. Technically, to have a property tax, you have to have the National People's Congress pass it as a new law. There is a tax on the books for commercial properties, and there's some talk that they can actually just modify that without going through the NPC and then introduce a property tax, an annual percentage property tax based on the value of your property. There are a whole bunch of problems with that. You don't have the infrastructure for property assessment. It's not like the U.S. where, I mean, who gets the money? Does it go to the municipal people? Does it go to your county? Does it go to your schools? How does the money get paid out? The government has been running these trials, these sort of virtual trials in several cities where they claim they've worked out some of these issues, but nobody's willing to give a timeline. And one of the issues, too, that is you got a real problem around corruption because there are a lot of people who have apartments that shouldn't have apartments and can't afford apartments, and there are people who have some say in how these laws get passed.
Right, I think it was interesting. You posted the other day. Right?
And if all of a sudden they have to pay taxes on these properties, either it's going to cause them problems to disclose it, or where are they going to get the money to spend the 50, 100,000, 200,000 RMB a year in tax? And the last point I'll make is also this idea that a property tax that was going to burst the bubble. What is that based on in terms of logic? Because the U.S. has had a property tax for decades, and we just had one of the biggest housing bubbles in history.
Let's talk about that actually a little bit. There are two more topics that I want to touch on. Gadi, first I want to ask you a little bit about commercial property here. We've been talking primarily about residential. I think it's fair to draw a pretty clear distinction. I walk around Beijing and I see pretty high vacancy rates right now. I'm sure that's the same in a lot of other cities.
Right. Back when I wrote my last There's a Housing Bubble story in 2008.
You've written a few.
I've written a couple over
Hanging
the years.
That drum again, are you?
This one was actually about the kind of crash that did happen, but it was sort of just a short-term one, the one that Bill just mentioned.
Only part of the sky.
Right around when the financial crisis took place. I wrote right before that, right around the Olympics in Beijing, I wrote about the problems in the housing market and in commercial real estate. And a guy by the name of Jack Rodman, who's of counsel at King & Wood here and is a sort of longtime distressed assets guy in Asia. His business is, you know, properties in trouble or assets in trouble. He took me around Beijing on a tour of empty Class A office space. Class A is the top grade of right. office space. And there was just, I mean, just oceans of it. Tons of buildings that we were looking at that didn't even have one floor leased. Some of them brand new. Some of them a couple of years old. They were lining Beijing's major thoroughfares, the Second Ring Road, the Third Ring Road, you know, other east-west axes. They were and it was – the question behind it is always, well, what about the bank loans that funded these buildings? Who's owning these buildings? You know, what's their financial situation? Some of them have been bought by state-owned insurers, airlines.
How's Jack Robdon's business doing now?
Well, what he does is he's, of course, advising people who might want to come into this market or who might want to get money out of this market. At that time, it looked clear to me that you know, Beijing and more property was coming online, mm-hmm. that you have a real problem in the commercial real estate market. And leasing rates were so low that none of these properties were economical at that time, and they aren't now. And then you also have in other cities like Tianjin, you know, not far from Beijing, you have huge amounts of office space coming online without the major tenants that you normally expect. I mean, you have in Beijing at least you have all the, you know, major multinationals or, you know, big financial service companies need to have office space, law firms. There's less clear demand for that in some of the second-tier cities.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget there are, what, 163 cities in China with populations over a million.
The commercial real estate, one, a lot of these buildings, as you know, because you've talked to Jiangxi and the Soho people, is the developers actually just sell off individual units. And so a lot of the developers have no risk left in these projects.
Well, Soho is one example of that, what's called a strata developer of office space. They are doing okay because they sell off by floors. These other buildings that I'm talking about are not developed on that basis.
Okay. And then we spent a big chunk of December and January looking for retail space in Beijing CBD and probably looked at every retail space within a 10 to 15 minute walk of China World.
We being you and Carol.
Yes, for her business. And it is terrifying. The office spaces are like Chao Wai Soho and Soho Chang, they're actually full or close to full, but the retail mm-hmm. is a wasteland. It's like a neutron bomb went off in these places. And there's...
You mean the retail or the office?
The retail. The retail is just a ghost town. And what was interesting, though, as we looked at a lot of these properties, was in many of these places, there wasn't movement on the rent. The rents were way out of whack. And the answer was, well, these guys don't care. They paid in cash. They live in Shaanxi. They live in Inner Mongolia. They could care less.
There's another reason that rents haven't gone down officially, which is none of these guys who own these buildings want to mark to market. You know, the value of the building would go down if they're leasing their floors right. at much lower rates than they claim they can
lease. Oh, so they could be like U.S. banks and mark to fantasy.
Right. Right. That's
Perfect.
What they do.
That's learning from the great capitalist nation of the world, right?
It's interesting because that's a variation of the same thing we've seen with residential property a lot too. People will buy it. They won't bother to rent it. They certainly won't bother to rent it if they can't get a price that meets whatever they think they should be getting for mm-hmm. it. The properties will sit open as long as people feel they can get the investment value out of it.
But but to your question, I mean, is it a bubble? I think the answer is it depends, right? I mean, China is a big country. There are a lot of cities. Not every city is a bubble. Some places, Hainan province, Hainan Island is absolutely a bubble. Residential versus commercial is very different. Like Gary was just saying, I mean, commercial is a real problem in a lot of cities. Residential, it depends on the city. It depends on the area. Some parts of China, the residential is not at all in a bubble. And there, I mean, people underestimate, I think, especially some of the Western China bears. It's funny because on the one hand, they mock China for having crappy official and false official statistics. On the other hand, they use those statistics to justify why China's real estate is overvalued. And I mean, one thing in Beijing, for example, which is a market that we all know a lot about, the whatever numbers you use for the income, like what the average Beijing's income is, way understates what people's real income is. There's a whole lot of gray income,
right.
And a market like Beijing is a national market. And so the actual affordability ratio is much more favorable than I think a lot of the people would say.
But I think you do see the speculative buy and flip mentality that has been at the core of any sort of bust in a market. I think, and you could have that problem here, certainly.
Right.
I mean, we just saw this story by David Pearson in the Los Angeles Times about Hefei. Which is in Anhui
Province. Provincial capital of Anhui. Yeah.
And it's in...
Not a backwater.
If you walk down the street in Beijing, you don't hear a lot of people saying, you know, I just got to get me to Hefei. I mean,
Well, I think what we're seeing though is the popularity of the war juice, the soap opera, right? Mm-hmm. About how unaffordable housing is in Shanghai. You know, this has clearly become a social stability issue for the government. And the government does lots of, you know, they pay a lot of attention to what people think here. And I think if you look at the root cause of you know, clashes in the provinces, if you look at the root cause, even in outside of Beijing.
Many of them have to do with
most real estate, of them have to do something real estate related, corrupt officials, corrupt real estate developers, relocation, not getting paid, getting forced off their land. Then you have the middle class who increasingly can't afford these properties. And so from the perspective of the party and keeping power, this is probably one of their top, if not the top issue in terms of social stability.
Will, how do you rate the government's ability to communicate around this issue?
A lot of the measures that have been taken in the last few months are designed – I mean, they're designed to be effective regulations, or I think the government hopes that they'll be effective regulations. But there is definitely a communications component there. We are doing something. We are trying to handle the market. We're working to control this.
Well, they're trying to speak to two constituencies. They're the haven't-bought-yet constituencies and the I-already-own property.
Well, the question is, which constituency are you more worried about at any given time? And as time goes by, the constituency to be more worried about is going to be the have-not constituency. And that's
not necessarily, though, because a lot of the have-bought are people who actually decide these policies. So if you drive the price down too much, you're hurting yourself.
This is why we call it a dilemma.
Yeah.
But the have-bots have a lot to lose. Not people who aren't helping make policy, but they're middle-class homeowners mm-hmm. who have a lot to lose if prices go down, and they could end up being a very unhappy constituency.
But the question is going to be, where does the risk come from in the future? Is the biggest risk going to come from the people who are already owners, or is the biggest risk going to come from people who start to feel disenfranchised? That is a tough balance to strike.
The answer may be both.
Maybe both.
And that's where, you know, it would be not a great job to be trying to manage this in China, because it's a really, really complex problem.
Then their big challenge is going to be landing this baby smoothly.
And the interesting thing is, I think we can all agree that we could have had this exact same discussion with all the same elements 3 years ago.
Well, we'll have it again next year.
And the question is, will we still be having this discussion 3 years from now?
Well, 3 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to ask this one question, which is, how does this compare to the United States? You know, China, there's a lot less leverage in the system. Is that not unfair?
Well, there's a lot less consumer leverage.
Yes. In other words, the creative financing in China is more by the government than sure. it is by individuals. And so you don't have nearly the kind of 100% mortgages or 90% mortgages. Technically not legal here. I'm sure some people manage to basically borrow everything to buy their house. But it's not nearly on the scale it was in the U.S. as prices were going up.
Sure. No second and third mortgages.
And you have the government. I mean, you know, the government is very good at learning here. You know, it takes them a while sometimes, but I think they've been very clear about some of the lessons of the crash in the U.S., and one of them was this laissez-faire approach to an out-of-control housing market and to not trying to manage asset bubbles. And so I think what you're seeing is the government taking a very muscular approach to try and push this asset bubble down without actually crashing it.
I mean, because if you had to crudely draw a comparison to what year we are in here in China in U.S. terms, are we in 2006? Are we in 2007?
Well, I think we're way earlier because, you know, you got to remember most people in China are still pretty poor.
Right.
And in the U.S., a lot of this was building these big mansions that nobody needed. The Western bears, like these guys who are short China or short parts of China, to Chanos' credit, he's not actually short China. He's short specific things
that make
a lot of sense. These guys wouldn't last a night in your average Beijinger's house.
You might argue we're in the roaring 20s, I mean, in the U.S. You have still a lot of poor people in the countryside, but you have a whole, you know, generation of new wealth in the cities.
Right. But we already have the stock market. I mean, you got to remember the stock market crashed in 2006, right? It hit over 6,000, and right now it's at 2,900.
One of the biggest differences is that, well, Beijing is on it. They're aware of the extent of the problem. They're aware of it, whereas Washington was very much – or New York was very much caught with its pants.
Yeah, but we've been talking about the difficulty of managing the particular dilemma in the market here. So it's one thing to be aware that you have a problem. It's another to have a solution for managing it in the long term.
Remember, I mean, after the financial crash, prices in parts of Beijing or other cities went down 30%. In the U.S., that was the magnitude of the crash for a lot of places.
Right.
And look at the damage it caused. What did that 20-30% drop in over the space of a few months in Beijing at the end of 2008? What did that do?
Right. It seems to have a more isolated impact
and
a much larger.
It did not take down the economy.
Right. No, but each iteration of this situation, sorry, I'm the bear by inclination, I guess. the next time it happens, it may play out differently than it did last time. And that's the danger.
I agree with that. And I would put myself in that bear camp. I'd just be careful about trying to predict when crisis is going to hit, when there is one.
I don't have the stones for that, that's for sure.
But also, I mean, I think you have to look at what the government cares about. I think the government cares much more about protecting the residential market and making sure it doesn't crash than they may care about the commercial market. They cleaned up the banks before. I mean, let's face it. It's a tax on the economy if they have to deal with a bunch of bad assets on the banks. But they still control the banks. They'll still clean them up, right? And they can still do whatever accounting they need to do, like Wall Street does now with Mark II model, Mark II fantasy, whatever you call it, right? So, I mean, we live in a Mark II unmarket world. Basically, look at Europe. Look at Greece, right? Where in the world do people mark stuff to market right now?
I wonder what stage you think we're in now, whether you think we're at the stage where people are thinking, the average person on the street is thinking, I still want to get in on this craze, or are they now sort of afraid?
I
think there's a lot of trepidation right now.
My friends, we think maybe 20% drop in Beijing, and we're definitely buyers of, but they also feel that they can be more selective in where they buy. Part of the problem is it's basically people been buying anything.
Right.
And they haven't really been very discerning about quality. I think one of the things that's come out of this is there's going to be some separation between better locations versus places out in the suburbs. And that has this sort of mania. I think
that attitude is so sensitive to government policy and message and signaling.
Well, the government, I mean, the propaganda push has been astounding. If you read the papers since they rolled out the document, it's just every day there's articles about how they're cracking down on developers, they're cracking down on speculators, they're cracking down on multiple properties. The one thing I'll say from, I know last week you guys talked about the Huiyabang piece by Wen Jiabao. I actually think that essay is related to these property measures. And I think what we're seeing is a shift where the government realizes that they've let the real estate market get out of control. It's the biggest source of social instability in the country. And you're going to see much stronger policies that this time the government, I think, believes they have to make them stick or they're going to be.
I don't disagree at all. I think, I mean, if you had to sort of draw lines between the factions within the leadership in China and the constituencies that they're trying to address, clearly the Communist Youth League faction is more concerned with people who haven't bought yet, with the ant tribes.
Back to the property tax question. The most aggressive property tax proposal is in Chongqing, run by everyone's favorite
Prince
populist,
Bo
Xilai, where it is incredibly progressive. If you own multiple properties, if you own a bigger property than, you know, like 130 meters, you get taxed extremely heavily. The bigger transaction tax, very much a very, very populist, socialist proposal that may or may not get passed, but it's clear that they've staked out the position of where they think the market should be.
Well, if populists are ascendant, then that's just very smart politics by Bo Xilai, once again.
That may be a populist policy, or that may be actually reflecting also where he thinks policies out of Beijing are going to go too. Because you got to remember, we have a new leadership comes in 2 years. This is a very sensitive time. People are most likely, I think the risk here for the property developers is that the government and the people decide that they're going to overcompensate because they think that Beijing is serious. And so you might see a much harsher crackdown on property than people expected.
Guys, that's about all we have time for today. I want to thank you guys all for joining me, Bill, Dottie, Will. And thank you for listening to the Seneca Podcast. We'll see you again next week. Thanks again to Dave Lancashire and everyone at Pop-Up Chinese for hosting this podcast and for letting us use their fine studio. See you next week.